Captain's log, stardate 47941.7. The Enterprise is en route to a briefing on the situation in the demilitarized zone along the Cardassian border. Meanwhile, we're celebrating the return of an old friend.
Am I the noble friend?
Well, it was Lieutenant Rowe, but you know. I suppose it's always open to interpretation.
Exactly.
Right. Welcome aboard, cadets, officers, and visiting alien dignitaries. This is the Hit or Miss Star Trek podcast, where we navigate the wormholes of moral grey areas, debate the undebatable, and occasionally mutiny for the greater good. In Star Trek, the hardest choice isn't always between right or wrong. Sometimes it's between orders and your conscience. I am your regular host, Captain Michael Wilson, or Preemptive Mike, this week. And we're continuing our ongoing series looking at those complex and tragically linked species, the Bajorans and Cardassians. Now, a few weeks ago, we reviewed Next Generation's Ensign Rowe, and this will be part two of what I'm basically calling our Rowe Laren trilogy. We were supposed to have, returning from that episode, our complete Rowe Squadron, as I'm calling them. Yes, I know, wrong universe, but you know. Allow me this one. We are not fully assembled. Unfortunately, for whatever reason, we appear to have had some crossed wires. Our subspace communications are down and we've not been able to reach Jordan. In the meantime, you are stuck with me and my one guest for this week, returning from that squadron with clarity, insight, and a well-timed eyebrow raise. It's the ever insightful Rune. Glad to have you aboard, Rune.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yes, I've got a packed episode coming up, including our review and deep dive into this week's focus episode, which will be Preemptive Strike. Yes, we've gone from Laren's first Next Gen appearance to her last, a pivotal and powerful farewell that still sparks debate. It's also the second last episode ever of Next Generation. So, yeah, intriguing. And as we were mentioning off air, Rune and myself, not a great run of episodes towards the end of season 7, but we'll see what we make of this one. Oh, boy. But before we get into undercover ops and shifting loyalties, we do have some quick phaser blast of opinions coming up in this week's hit or miss section. So, we'll forego the usual hailing frequencies open because we've talked at length about your sort of Trek journey, your likes, dislikes, your favourite Cardassian and Bajoran things. So I'll jump straight into the hit or miss section instead.
What about my performance?
I'm not a drama critic.
Whew.
Hit so. Oh gosh, I have to do this all by myself this week.
I'm afraid so.
I'm focused. So, yes. Let's do it.
Well, unless Jordan turns up, so cross your fingers that she does.
Jordan!
So, yeah, I mean, you've done this before, so you know what to expect. But just for the benefit of any new listeners or anyone that's unsure, basically, I just shout out something from anywhere in the Trek universe, ask if it's a hit or a miss. We debate it back and forth, just the two of us, it looks like, and decide if we can come to some kind of consensus. Or I guess if it's 50-50, we'll just have to simply mark it down as divisive. But and because I've been doing that during this season anyway, I do have a handful of things that would relate to Bajorans and Cardassians, but again, not everything. And for some reason, I got carried away, so I've got 12 things to choose from this week. And again, I'm doing it kind of lottery style, so I'm going to have to ask you to pick numbers. And again, you're on your own on this one because Jordan isn't here to do it. So hopefully there'll be things that you have an opinion on and that we can use.
I'll make up an opinion for you today. How about that?
We could probably use the help at this point. Things are not going well. But yeah, that's fair enough. Exactly. Yeah, I got carried away writing things, and I was like, we've only got a handful of episodes. I think this and one more episode left this season, so I'll probably get through most of them. So we'll maybe get through about four today. We usually do that. So we'll start by saying, would you like to pick a number between 1 and 12, please?
3. 1 and 12.
Okay. I did say it. I got carried away. Number 3 is an episode and does relate to our overall theme. It's a DS9 episode, and again, if you need me to jog your memory, because you know sometimes it's the title isn't enough, please say. So hit or miss for the episode Tribunal.
Tribunal. Ooh, I remember that title.
That is Okay, I'll let you. If any viewers or listeners aren't sure, basically this is the episode where Miles O'Brien finds himself arrested and put on trial in a Cardassian court, where we learn you are guilty until proven innocent. The exact reverse of our
system. Okay, this is a hit. That's what we're doing,
also
right?
Hit on this. So what? Sorry, I was just having a drink. And so what reasons would you give for the...
No drinking. It's been maybe 8 years since I've watched DS9. I don't remember it, but I love Miles O'Brien and I will watch anything with him in it. And I get excited just when I see him in anything else. So, but yeah, like, as I recall, this was pretty good episode. Is this the one where they like took out his back teeth or something? Did they do that?
Genuinely not sure if that's this one or Hard Time, because there are so many what they call O'Brien must suffer episodes that some of the moments, the smaller moments, just bleed through.
Poor Brian. But,
I do recall this one was basically he was set up by what turns out to have been a Cardassian agent disguised as a human. And, you know, he didn't commit this crime, obviously, but he was in jail. And as I said, the interesting part was that, you know, as soon as you've been arrested for a crime, you're assumed guilty and you've got to prove your innocence, which, like I said, is so backwards to us.
Truly.
And yet. Yeah, and so Odo's obviously on board to try and do his thing as the security officer, and O'Brien's this whole time is suffering in the Cardassian prison and having to cope with all that, so yeah.
Okay, so this is a hit for me. I love O'Brien, and we love to hate the Cardassians, so yeah. I see no problems, and from the images I'm seeing, the lighting is stellar, so.
Yeah, it all takes place on Cardassia inside the equivalent of their cult,
DS9 was really good about stellar lighting. Like, they were the first one to really, like, do that in their series.
Yeah, and if she were here, I'm sure Lady Vian would comment on how much she loves the Cardassian architecture and designs. Mm. She said that every week we've done an episode, and I'm like, it's just, like, really dull brown and green.
It is. But, you know.
She loves it. Yeah.
She's not here to defend herself, though, so we can say whatever we want.
Exactly. That's why I said that, because otherwise I'd get a thump.
Poor Jordan.
No, not Jordan. It was Vian I was talking
about. Oh, Vian. Sorry.
From the previous episodes, but no, I'm Jordan. I like Cardassian architecture, but no, Vian's not here because she's actually at Star Trek Las Vegas at the moment, so she deserves she deserves all the criticism we can give her, because she just had a picture taken with the whole Voyager cast.
Lovely.
She sent it to me on private message, and I was forced to say, "I'm so happy for you, and not remotely jealous." That was a lie, of course, obviously.
It was a lie, right? Gritted teeth and everything.
Oh. Exactly, yeah. Anyway, back to the episode. But no, yeah. I kind of, I mean, we're not going to have anything divisive here. I agree. I love Tribunal. I can't remember every last inch of it, but like I said, I can remember it being a really interesting story of how O'Brien, I mean, we knew he was innocent, but how exactly he got set up in this surgically altered Cardassian. And like I said, the thing that really stuck with me was the idea of the Cardassian justice system just being so harsh and you being treated like a criminal from the get-go, really, you know, and having to as I said. And then it always reminds me a little bit, there's a Enterprise episode similar to this called Judgment, where it's like Archer on trial in a Klingon sort of tribunal, and he also has, you know, a lawyer of that species trying to defend him. And you know, a Cardassian, you have to be assigned to be your lawyer, but they're doing the wrong thing. And and then, obviously, as I said, Odo, you get him coming in and doing the defense and realizing he's got unstoppable odds to try and face. So, yeah, I think it's a hit. Like I said, it was, and it was, I mean, I always like the, as you said, the O'Brien must suffer type episodes anyway, because Cold Meany's a good actor, so he can portray it quite well. And it sounds like I hate that character, like saying that I like those, but you always get good dramatic episodes out of them. So,
exactly.
Yeah. It's not that I dislike O'Brien. It's not like I enjoy just seeing him in pain or anything.
No. He's just good at what he does. And, I enjoy him getting... he came from like a bit character on TNG to like being this fully fleshed out, like, good for him.
Absolutely, yeah. But he was in the pilot, as you said, but it was like a random, just an extra somewhere, yeah.
What a way to get into it.
Fantastic. But no, I love that episode for, as I said, exploring a little bit more about the Cardassian culture and everything, because we knew very little. I mean, it was only season 2, I think, of DS9, so we still weren't quite aware of every last inch of their homeworld and what they were like, and that was an interesting wrinkle. So, anyway, enough. We can say that is a hit, so we can stamp that one. And yeah, if we'd like to pick another number between 1 and 12, then.
let's go with 9.
Yeah, I mean, I would, but it's kind of pointless me picking a number. I know what they all are. Weirdly enough, 9 is another episode, or two-parter episode, actually, and is DS9 again. So, oh, wow. hit or miss for Favor the Bold and Sacrifice of Angels.
Oh, I don't remember this.
Again, just in case anybody's listening and not sure, this is the big end of Season 6's intro arc, where they take back the station that's been taken over by the Cardassians and Dominion. And there's epic space battles. The Defiant flies into the wormhole and the Prophets have to stop an invading Dominion fleet.
Yes.
And spoiler alert, the saddest thing that happens at the end of this is, of course, Zial is killed as they're escaping the station by Damar. So, yeah, lots going on. And as I said, it's the end of that. There was like 6 episodes at the start of Season 6 that dealt with the station being taken over and Starfleet having to repel the Dominion and ultimately take it back. So, yeah.
I wasn't raised on DS9. This was not a favorite in my household, so I've watched it as an adult.
Okay.
So it's not like one that I've like rewatched at all, I don't think. I think I've only had the one like end-to-end run of it that I binged. So I'm going to, and I don't remember anything that I haven't liked about that show at all, but we'll go with a hit for this one because it sounds exciting.
That's fair enough. Yeah, no, it really is. I mean, this one I know inside and out because it is one of my absolute favorites of DS9. Yeah. So I just love, like I said, I love that arc anyway. So I was waiting for, you know, because I remember when season 5 ended with the Dominion and the Cardassians taking over the station, and it was like the executive producers sort of went on record as saying, just so you know, this isn't like a, you know, in the second part, the start of next season, we're not going to have them take it back in one episode. This is going to be an ongoing thing. And
yeah,
so I was kind of pleasantly surprised it took like 6 episodes till we got to this point and this big two-parter, which, like I said, is, it's kind of, without wanting to get too far, because there's so much going on, there's like they finally found a way to dismantle the mines that are in the way of the wormhole that was left when they left. And
Odo
has basically tested his loyalties and he's now basically fully kind of under the thrall, I guess, of the female shapeshifter at this point. So he kind of ends up screwing things up and getting Rom arrested for trying to, you know, keep the minefield going. And like, as I said, just, you know, I'm a sucker for, you know, spaceships and things, and it has the biggest and best space battles in this two-parter, where basically, you know, a Dominion Cardassian fleet and a Federation Klingon fleet are just facing off, and there's an abundance of cool CGI spaceships all firing pew-pew lasers. So I would have loved the episode anyway, but I mean, there's so much cool drama and cool character stuff. And I said, that's an absolutely devastating ending of Zial's death, and the way that drives Dukat completely insane was heart-wrenching. So there's so much going on, but I mean, even if that wasn't, like I said, I would still say hit just because of the really cool CG space battles. And I also love the, again, spoilers if you haven't seen this episode, but it is like decades old now.
Yeah, they're fine.
I love the way that I love the way that the Defiant is kind of, you know, it gets through the lines and everything, and it's just this one ship flies into the wormhole, finds out there's an entire, you know, armada of Dominion ships about to advance. And Sisko basically has to appeal to the Prophets and be like, look, I need a miracle if you want to be gods, and Bajor needs a miracle. So please stop these ships. And the Prophets just, you know, disappear this entire Dominion fleet.
Right.
But tell Sisko, you know, there's going to be a price to pay for this. It's not for nothing.
Oh, yeah,
anything.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, God, shit.
Anything for free, do they?
Yeah, exactly. So I was like, this is so interesting and so intriguing. And then, as I said, it leads to at the end when the Dominion, like Wei Yun in charge of the station's like, hang on, what the happened to our fleet? Oh, shit.
Okay, this is making me want to rewatch DS9.
So yeah, the Defiant just coming out of the wormhole, opening fire on the station, and Wei Yun like, let them, we've got an entire, oh, hang on, what the heck? All right, time to leave, I guess.
They really did have such great storylines in that show.
It was really, I mean, I really loved it once they got into the meat of it. It took a couple of seasons to get going. And
I know it's
cliche, and some people would probably argue against, oh, the Dominion was, you know, such an obvious thing. But I do love all of the Dominion War stuff. I think it really works.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, I think we're going to see hits. I kind of steamrolled you on that one, but you'd already said hit, I presume, on that one.
I did, yeah. Hit. It was dramatic. We love drama. when it's not
so much drama in that. Like I said, the moment when I think it had actually been in a previous episode that Odo had basically allowed Rom to get captured because he was too busy linking with the female shapeshifter.
That was like real dirty for a little while.
It was really weird, and then him trying to apologize to Kira and her just being like, "We are way past sorry," just practically spitting in his face, like, "Oh shit!"
Fucking Kira, I love her.
Anyway.
Good stuff.
Well, if nothing else, I think I've sold you and probably half the audience on watching those episodes again.
100%.
It's the start of season 6. Why not pick a number again between 1 and 12, and that's what we don't hit another episode this time.
We're going to go with 6 because I'm doing 3s, apparently.
Okay, well, 6 is sensible. Well, we're still in the DS9 realm.
Sensible? You made all these.
I don't know why I even said that. It's not particularly one thing or the other. But yeah, we're still in the DS9 realm, but we're in the realm of ships because it's me. So apologies if you're not really a ship person.
I know nothing, but I will create an opinion.
I don't know if I've ever asked this before. I probably did because it's a pretty well-known, but I thought to ask you. And if I have, you know, we haven't had your opinion on this rune. So
not at all.
Hit or miss, for the USS Defiant.
Hit.
I mean, I don't need to explain what that is, basically.
No,
right?
I mean, look at her. What a cutie.
Huh? You've established that it's a feminine pronoun for the Defiant?
Yeah, it's a ship. They're all girls.
That's actually very true, yeah. that is naval tradition, yeah. Which I think says a lot about how lonely sailors used to get more than anything. But yeah.
And look at her. Her name's Defiant. She is like fighting the patriarchy. So I'm here for all of her shenanigans.
Oh man. Oh, this is the Rosie the Riveter of ships. I love it.
Exactly. You know what? Yes, put some blue coveralls on that girl. Yes, hit on Defiant. I don't have to think about it.
Okay. What do you, anything in particular that you like about it?
She's a feminist.
I love you're just making your own headcanon for
I told you if I didn't have opinion, I would make one up today.
Okay, but, fair enough.
No, she's just she's a cool ship. I mean, look at that. She's gorgeous. I don't know anything. It's like asking me about cars. I don't know. I just
Fair enough.
Cool. She's classic. I love her.
I would agree that it's a hit. It took me a while to warm to it because it is so not Starfleet, if you know what I mean. Like, it's not, it doesn't have a saucer section and, you know, two little sticky nacelles and a little drive. But for what it is, like, it's a warship, you know. Yeah, and
exactly.
It's designed to be that. And it's got, you know, it's got thick hull, no offense, Defiant. You know, cool pulse phasers and tons of weaponry, but it's nice and simple and compact enough. Not one of my favorites. I used to always get grief because I used to give it a lot of shit for the fact that it was in universe. It was designed to give a counteract against the Borg. Basically, it was designed to help fight the Borg. And the one time it went up against them, it lost terribly.
You can't just let Borg win, you know.
At the start of Star Trek First Contact, it's just like, you know, left adrift and Worf's beamed on the Enterprise and it's like, well, we'll salvage it. I'm like, that was what it was designed for. How damn bad is it at its job?
Perhaps today is a good day to die.
Prepare for ramming speed. No. we still need this. We've got 2.5 seasons of DS9 left. You're not destroying it.
I'm ready for ramming speed. Do it. It was an intense moment, and I'm here for it.
Exactly, yeah. Dramatic, you see?
Yeah, see?
She's a drama queen, the Defiant, as well.
Exactly. You know?
Just like all the best angry women, you know?
No shit.
I'm going to just ram it. Oh, okay, I won't. I've calmed down.
I'm fine.
Fine, let me go. But no, I mean, for use in the Dominion War, it was cool to see these kinds of things because, like I said, not everything can be a huge luxury liner when you're in the middle of a war situation. So it was kind of cool to see this. And like I said, not my favorite. It's a bit too small and a bit too un-Starfleet. But for what it is, I would still say hit. So,
Can you
this is very boring because we've just basically been in agreement with everything.
You really have.
But you know, I think we've given people some stuff to think about. Sue, would you like to pick one more number between one and
12? Let's see. I've done 3, 6, 9. How about 12?
Okay. 12, I actually included because I wanted Jordan's opinion on this, but you can get yours.
He's not
here to give it. So there we go. Because I remember Jordan saying... Jordan saying she wasn't a ship person, but she really loved the Enterprise NX-01. Mm-hmm. So I was curious to know her opinion, now that it is officially canon, on the Enterprise NX-01 refit. Which, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but that's what it is on screen. It was basically, again...
If you're, there he is.
There we go. Sorry, it's not the best picture, but...
It took a second to clear it up for me. Okay.
You get the idea. But if you're not familiar, if you're listening to this, it was Doug Drexler, who does a lot of the ship designs, basically came up with a concept for a refit of Enterprise that would have happened in the fifth season had it went on and hadn't been cancelled, which would have basically brought it much closer in line with Kirk's Enterprise that we know from the original series. Mm-hmm. And it was only ever a concept. It appeared on like calendars and it was kind of, fan canon for a while. But then it was included by the makers of Picard season 3 in the Fleet Museum that appears in that season, which officially made it canon as like, well, there we go. It must have went through this refit at some point, and that's how it's stored in the Fleet Museum. And this is what it looks like. So, yeah. What do you make of the refit of the NX-01?
Does she go? She moves. She does all the things she's supposed to do.
I mean, as far as I know.
Was she a dud? There's no history here. I don't know.
Well, that's the thing. We just don't know because we haven't
this
seen any.
This is purely an aesthetic thing, I feel.
Yeah. It basically
she's
is.
Not I as think dramatic. She's not as dramatic as the Enterprise is. Like, she just feels like a compact wannabe version of Enterprise.
Well, of the NX-01, you mean?
Yeah, of that. Mm. Wait, I don't even know what that is. Hold on. Comparison. What is it supposed to look like? What's it called?
Well, the you've seen Star Trek Enterprise, right?
Yeah, NX-01. No.
Oh, you haven't? Okay. Well, then in that case, you won't have a clue.
Oh, is it the ship for that?
It was the ship from Enterprise, but like I said, basically, although this never actually officially happened, it was an idea to bring it by adding like a drive section and a little satellite dish and more similar warp nacelles to the original 1960s Enterprise. I think basically a lot of whether or not you like it will depend on how, married you are to liking that original Matt Jeffries Enterprise design from the 60s, because it is basically a kind of hybrid.
Okay.
So, I feel bad for making you ask you answer this when you have no
Jordan,
frame of reference.
This is all your fault. I was supposed to be in the back seat for this one. I don't know. You know what? We'll just make it a 5-star. We'll go with a hit because, she's cute. Okay. She's cute.
Yeah. I like it. I like what they did without completely losing the personality of the NX-01.
Yeah.
I do like that they made it look, like I said, that you can see it. Like when Enterprise first came out, a lot of people complained that the NX-01 looked too advanced for the era and looked like a kind of Akira class ship. Nerds will know what I'm talking about when I say that. For the ship before, Kirk's Enterprise, it didn't look anything like it. So I kind of like that this was like an attempt to make it look, okay, this is now officially you can see the lineage here. So I always appreciate that kind of thing because I'm a big old nerd. So it will be a hit one. we'll see a hit.
we'll just go all out on this one.
Absolutely. And I'll have to get Jordan's opinion on that when we get a chance to speak to her next.
Yeah, I want to hear it too. So make sure I get on.
hopefully next week, depending on if we've, I don't know if she just wanted both episodes. I don't know.
Next 10 minutes at any minute?
Yeah. Minute? Who knows? But anyway, that's going to conclude the hit or miss section for this week. And thanks for holding the fort with that one, Rune.
No worries.
Giving opinions as best you could on those. So anyway, with that out of the way, we'll jump into the main focus of the episode, which is going to be our episode review. And we'll begin our analysis of that.
That's fine. Analysis.
And as I said, our episode review for this week is Preemptive Strike, the penultimate episode of The Next Generation, Season 7 and series overall. The big kind of departure of Ensign Ro, what would be her last appearance for a long time, her last appearance ever until very recently, and then it became her last appearance for about 3 decades. But again, more on that at a later date. So, So to start us off, I have done, as I always do this season, I've come up with the poetry corner, I'm calling it. So I've got a limerick and a haiku. And I only have one person to embarrass myself in front of this week, since Jordan's not here to hear these, unless she listens back. So are you ready to hear my my slightly embarrassing limerick and haiku for this
episode? I am all ears.
Okay, so yeah, allow me to indulge my creative side, audience, and just, you know, just fast forward if you're not a lover of these. So, and again, credit to the Delta Flyers, to Garrett Wong and Robbie McNeil for letting me steal this idea. I say letting, they don't really have a choice. I'm sure they don't listen to this podcast, but, you know, just so they're aware, I know that I stole it from them. Anyway, so yeah, moving on to the, I'll start with a limerick because that seems to be everybody's favorite. So starting with a limerick to describe preemptive strike, it is as follows. Rose back with a brand new task. To put on a fake Mackie mask. But when she sees that their mission meets her own need for attrition, abandoning her morals is too much to ask.
Ooh. Nice. Ooh,
you have chills, don't you? I could
just A little bit.
I've given the episode more gravitas than it deserves.
I think you might have.
And moving on to the haiku then for this episode, which again, it's always harder trying to fit it into those syllables, but hopefully I've done a good job. It is Ro joins the Maquis, betrayal or belonging, Picard is broken.
Oh, wow. Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
How long does it take you to write this?
It varies. It's sometimes if I have a complete block, it can be, you know, half an hour waiting on something or trying things out. Sometimes it just comes to me like out of nowhere and I don't know where it comes from.
Love that.
These ones probably took about half an hour to just try a few things out and try and get in things that I knew I wanted to touch on. Like I knew I wanted to touch on the ending somewhere in one of them.
Uh-huh. And
so that's how I kind of ended up with Picard is broken at the end of the haiku. So yeah.
And do you typically write poetry? Is that like a thing you do?
No, it's just, like I said, I enjoyed when I, because I didn't listen to the Delta Flyers doing their Voyager reviews, but they started reviewing DS9 from the start, and I was like, well, I can jump on board now, because I've seen Deep Space Nine, so I've been listening to them ever since, and like I said, they share it out, so one of them does a haiku, one of them does a limerick to explain the episode, and I was like, I actually like this, it's interesting, it gives you an interesting perspective, because you have to kind of break the episode down into what it's ultimately about, and gives you a chance to, you know, exercise a bit of a creative side.
That's cool.
So yeah, I'm going to begin talking about Preemptive Strike, as I always do, by giving some behind-the-scenes information. So again, sorry, Rune, if you do want to jump in at any point, ask clarification or, you know, add anything to anything, feel free. And I'll try and get to it as quick as I can. But yeah, there's some interesting things here, I think. So hopefully you won't be too bored listening.
Not going to be bored at all, I swear.
Fair enough. So diving into the BTS then, the original title of this episode was The Good Fight, but it was felt that this title was too similar to All Good Things, which is why it was changed. According to Jerry Taylor, this episode did not come from a desire to bring Ro Laren back one last time. In fact, after actress Michelle Forbes turned down the chance to take her character to Deep Space Nine in the role that became Kira Nerys, her relationship with the show wasn't the best. Yet the series found itself rushing towards a deadline with no other workable story idea but this one, which depended on getting the actress back. Taylor was able to get on the phone directly with Michelle Forbes and pitch the story personally, convincing Forbes to commit to the series' penultimate episode. Yeah, I have thoughts about that. I normally don't stop and editorialize, but I have to say, at times it really did feel like, Michelle Forbes wasn't really wanting to be here during this episode.
Okay, it wasn't just me then. Okay.
Yeah, no, it definitely wasn't. And I have to say, this idea that, it wasn't just a desire to bring Ro Laren back. I listened to the commentary on the Blu-ray disc because this episode has one, and they basically slightly contradict this. They say that at the start of the seventh season, they had contracted Michelle Forbes for two episodes as Ro, and so they paid her for them because it's like a pay or play contract.
Yeah.
And so it got to the point where they were told basically either write an episode with Ro in or we've paid her for nothing.
Right.
So they had to write an episode for her. Jesus. So, yeah. So, I mean, there's nothing to say what the episode had to entail. So obviously the idea of her, you know, abandoning and joining the Maquis would have been something they would just come up with. But they did know they had to feature the character somewhere. And like I said, I just get the sense that Michelle Forbes really just wanted to have the money and didn't want to come in and do the job.
Right.
But for whatever reason, was either convinced or paid enough or, she just seemed bored for a fair chunk of this, to be honest. But again, maybe you disagree if you're a fan. I don't know. But The appearance of Admiral Nechayev and Gullivec was intended to add continuity to the developing Maquis arc. Likewise, the use of Klingons, Vulcans, and Native Americans as village extras was a subtle setup for the cast of Star Trek Voyager, which I hadn't realized, but then I was like, oh yeah, of course, they have a Vulcan, a Klingon, a Native American, so yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, I have to say, again, on the commentary, they do point out, yes, part of this episode was deliberately to set up the Maquis conflict for Voyager, because we'd had it established in DS9, you know, they'd done the introduction of the Maquis, and then it sort of fed over to Next Gen here, so again, it was to set that up and really point out it was something that affected the Star Trek universe, because it's going to be important on Voyager, although it really wasn't in the long run, but yeah, anyway. Speaking of Voyager, the lieutenant commander who Ro Laren refers to as her instructor of advanced tactical training in 2369/70 and who joined the Maquis was intended by the producers as a reference to Chakotay, as was the Native American connection made in that episode and previously in Journey's End. Oh. In fact, this information is included in Ro Laren's biography at StarTrek.com. Whilst not canon in the truest sense, that intention was ultimately contradicted in the Voyager episode In the Flesh, in which Chakotay stated that he resigned his commission on March the 3rd, 2368. There is some people that argue that's just a continuity error, and it still is Chakotay that she's referring to. So, you know, choose for yourself, I guess.
Right.
Anyway, as part of the plan in this episode to lure the Maquis in with fears of a biogenic weapon, Ro mentions that one of the items being transported to the disputed area is biomimetic gel. Oh, sorry, I put my teeth in.
One more time.
She says that it is perfectly legal and does not seem concerned about it, stating that it is harmless on its own. However, when talking about this substance in DS9's In the Pale Moonlight, Captain Sisko states that it is strictly controlled by the Federation and not available at any price, implying the substance is much more dangerous than stated here. What can you say? Someone done messed up.
Right.
Interestingly, the actress Shannon Cochran reprised her role of Kalita in the Deep Space Nine third season episode, Defiant. I've seen this episode in Defiant multiple times and never made that connection that it's the same person. Same actress, same character. And when I read that, I was like, oh, yeah! She is, isn't she? She's on the Defiant with Thomas Riker in that episode. So, yeah. She also, interestingly, plays Cirella, Jadzia Dax's future mother-in-law and a Klingon in her wedding episode, You Are Cordially Invited, which is a really good role and completely nothing like this.
Right. So,
good actress. And finally, this is Natalia Nagulich's last appearance as Alina Nechayev. Sorry if I butchered all of the Russian there. In Star Trek The Next Generation, although she had also appeared in Next Gen and in the DS9 episode The Maquis Part 2. And she did go on to star in the DS9 episode The Search Part 2, although not really, because that appearance was part of a virtual reality simulation and not the real Nechayev. I actually quite like this character. She was kind of a bit part, but she was one of the rare good admirals that appeared in the show.
That whole thing where every time an admiral comes on, you're like, well, what are you doing?
Yeah. Although, to be fair, she does have that one moment where she's like, if you get a chance to infect the Borg with a virus, I suggest you fucking do it, mate. it's a little boy we want to see. I don't give a shit.
Right? That's still genocide, guys.
I mean, it is the Borg, though. So. She has a point. That's all I'm saying. That's all I had apart from, like I said, I've mentioned a couple of the things from the commentary. The only other thing of note, which again appeals to me and probably similar nerds but will maybe raise a few eye rolls from other people, this episode has at the time the greatest number of single ships in one shot during the battle at the very start where the Maquis attack the Cardassian ship.
Oh nice.
There we go. I think it's pre-CGI as well, so it is all actually models. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah, so probably it will be officially the most model ships in one shot for a while, because they switched after that.
I do appreciate a good practical.
Yeah, I like that battle, actually. I thought it looked really good. A lot of the stuff looks good on the enhanced Blu-ray now that they've, you know, that they did a while back. They kind of upgraded the effects and gave it a polish and made it up to HD standard, and it looks really good.
Nice.
So, yeah. There we go. So yeah, before we carry on and break down the little sections that we normally do for the episode, I do, as you probably know, always start with asking if you can remember what your first experience was of seeing this. Was it at the time when it went out, or many a year ago? And do you have any lasting memories from the first time you saw it, Rune?
No lasting memories. Definitely was not in its first play because I didn't watch a lot of DS9 when it first came out. I remember,
this is a Next Gen episode, Rune, but okay.
Oh my God. We did so many hit or miss on DS9.
I mean, it's very DS9 coded, what with the Maquis and everything.
It is. Wow. My bad. So, actually, yes, I would have watched this on its first run because we were actively watching Star Trek during its final season, TNG. But I don't remember. I don't remember watching it, so... Yeah. Yeah.
If you were kind of not watching DS9, then I would imagine, and again, if you don't remember, it's no point asking, but I would imagine you probably would have been not confused, but kind of not really on board with the Maquis and kind of their introduction and not knowing what it was all about. I mean, I think they're explained in this episode enough that you would understand, you'd get it. But certainly if you were watching both series together, you know, you'd appreciate it more as a like, oh, it's those guys that debuted in DS9 like 10 weeks ago or whatever.
Yeah, I've always had an appreciation for the Maquis, so... You know,
really? Oh, okay. That's
really have. Yeah, I don't know why.
Okay. Okay, that's one of the questions I was going to come to later. So I'm intrigued to hear about that because, yeah, they're very. I don't know. I would say divisive, but not really. It's just one of those weird things where
it's like a gray area. Yeah. Probably.
It is and it isn't, and it brings out the best and the worst in the other characters at times. Anyway.
So. Yeah. But
no. Anyway, I can remember seeing this the first time when it would have been. I think I worked out I was 14 years old, the last time I saw this, and I don't think I've seen it since when I gave it a rewatch. And the thing that lasted in my memory was very much the ending, which stayed with me for like 3 decades because that ending is so powerful.
Yeah.
You know, Ro deciding to betray and then. Just the choice of Picard just silently staring and not seeing anything, not like raging or anything, just seething like that, I think really did stick with me at the time. And I was like, oh, wow, he's affected by this. You know, we haven't seen, even when he was like assimilated and brought back, he had like maybe like a few seconds of being that affected. And so this, I was like, whoa, Picard is yikes. And like I said, that was always my memory of this in my brain, was that it was such a powerful and cool and dramatic episode. And I think I must have just blanked out the majority of the rest of the episode that gets you there until that very last kind of 5 minutes or so, because, oh boy, a lot of it on the way is rough now that I watched it back. Although saying that, as a, you know, as a 14-year-old, I probably didn't at the time quite appreciate or understand the level of cliche. I was, you know, you haven't established cliches and you haven't seen enough, you know, media yet to know what a cliche is. So, you know, when somebody dies and says, like, oh, when somebody dies, you know, and they're 2 days from retirement, somebody always takes their place.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, when that scene happened, I was just like, I almost had to pause and be like, what? They didn't.
They
Jesus.
Did.
That's so on the nose. Somebody's picking snots out of it. Jesus. Anyway. Moving on. Anyway, because we basically have started talking about it, so we'll move and we'll start talking about the writing and the plot in this episode. The teleplay is by Renee Echevarria and the story is by Narain Shankar. I mean, I hope they're not listening because I don't have great things to say. I mean, it's not terrible. There's some really great stuff in here, but there is some, let's say, shortcuts, some cliche, and some very weird choices.
Yeah. And
something I've said a lot during this kind of Bajoran Cardassian season, it just feels like there's too much to fit into a 45-minute episode of television as well. Like, they really try to fit too much in, and I don't know how successful that is.
Yeah.
Especially when they take shortcuts and cliches to get you there. And so, anyway, so I want to start by, you know, the first thing that's worth talking about is obviously Ro, you know, her journey in this episode, her defection to the Maquis, because we did already review Ensign Ro, and so we dealt with her introduction to the show and how she kind of came on board and everything. So, yeah, we know from the start of this episode she'd been away for advanced tactical training. She hadn't appeared since the season 6 episode Rascals. Mm-hmm. And yeah, first of all, there's a very different attitude to her from the Enterprise crew than the last episode. That was very jarring, having not seen the episodes in between.
Yeah.
And we came from Ensign Ro to, her like dissing everybody and, you know, batting away Beverly and Troy to her going to 10 forward and being overwhelmed by everybody. Like, oh, welcome back. We love you. Oh, it's so great to see you.
Exactly.
Like, oh, hang on. Okay. So, but anyway, we immediately get the you know, very incredibly close relationship to Captain Picard and some slightly inappropriateness, I want to say.
Can we talk about that one scene? Because that made me feel weird.
There's a couple, but which scene in particular are you talking about?
The one where they're like pretending a proposition so they can talk.
Mm.
I didn't that was awkward.
That's very, very weird. And I think I'll mention it in direction, but it's even weirder when you know that Patrick Stewart directed the episode. Oh. So, yeah, he chose to put himself in that position.
Oh, man.
I mean, I get it and I understand it, but yeah, there's some very awkward kind of tension in that moment. And
yeah,
I just, more importantly, though, logically within the kind of plot of the episode, it doesn't make sense to me and it left me baffled.
Yeah.
I get it if the idea is that, oh, she's trying to make out that she's a prostitute or whatever, and she's being propositioned, and that's how she's kind of doing this meeting in the bar. But I was like, but that wouldn't make sense to any of the other Maquis, because they know she's not a prostitute.
Yeah.
So how exactly is this, like, that's no defense really there, is it?
Like, the only connection it had was when she, like, started making out with that random guy when
which is dodgy as well, by the way.
Right. Yeah. Like, hello.
Just non-consensually snugging some guy. Right. For like,
you look like all right, you Jesus. This. Jeez. Yeah. The 90s,
although I did,
right?
I did actually laugh when she came into the bar the second time and the guy gets up off his chair and she's like, not tonight.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. But no, it didn't make a lot of sense. And I think I realized at the time, I was like, well, of course, there are none of her Maquis kind of cellmates or whatever in the bar, because why would this is even weirder now?
Yeah.
Why have you suddenly decided to, you know, be a hooker for this guy out of nowhere? You know, you have to explain yourself better. But anyway, like I said, I get the point, is, although I have my own issues with that scene that I will probably get to shortly ish because it's under this writing. But, oh boy. Anyway, but yeah, my kind of, I just, again, you say 90s and maybe things were a bit more innocent then, or we just didn't care. But like Picard's very first words to Ro are, oh, you look very fit. Tactical training.
Right? I noticed that. Like,
huh?
What are we doing, guys? Come on.
First of all, it's not particularly appropriate for the captain to be like, oh, I thought you needed saving from this crowd of people, so I've just, you know, called you away for a one-on-one with me. And then immediately, oh, you look very fit. I'm like, whoa, back off, Picard. Yeah. You
know? No, it's weird.
It's very odd. I mean, I don't suppose it's intended to be that way. Had it been a kind of mentee, right, you know, between two men or whatever, you wouldn't have had that. But
yeah,
they must have been aware. It's kind of an old man and a younger woman, right, you know. And surely. Anyway, but yeah, and again, it feels a bit like a shortcut, but I can't really comment on it in this episode so much as, you know, because it's obviously feeds through all of the episodes. But she's very suddenly like, oh, I have to take this mission to validate your faith in me, Picard. I would be nowhere if it wasn't for you. And I'm like, I don't remember, other than that one scene at the end of Ensign Row, I can't remember her and Picard really being that kind of like him sticking up for her constantly and always taking her side. And again, it kind of reeked of like, oh, hang on, I see what's happening. Oh, yeah. Picard, you're the very best. I was like, so something's going to happen.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're setting this up for a reason.
Yeah, you can see it coming.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, so many, when Picard's like, oh, you're going to lead him into a trap, I knew I could count on you. I'm like, oh, don't say things like that, Picard. That's like, I'll be right back in a horror movie. I mean, come on.
Right.
But yeah, getting to that scene you were talking about, because that was the next thing in my notes here. I just think, and I don't know why I didn't pick this up at the time. Like I said, I think it may have been because I loved Captain Picard and I wanted to be here when I was younger. And so
It
never occurred to me until watching this scene now. He is an absolute dick to her in this scene. Like,
yeah.
He doesn't give any, you know, concession towards her feelings as a Bajoran or about the Cardassians or that she might have torn loyalties. And,
right,
you know, I kind of expected that he would be like, look, if you're not comfortable with this, we'll pull you off the mission. You know, we've done enough. We can maybe get somebody to infiltrate again. Nothing's lost here. We haven't blown your cover. But instead, it's the way he's like,
I'll have you court-martialed.
Exactly. It's like, if you back out now, you'll throw away everything you've worked for. I could put you before a board of inquiry for lying to me just now. I can certainly have you court-martialed if you sabotage the mission. What a dick!
Right. Very out of character for him.
Like, incredibly out of character for him. Mm. And this is where I have to interject, because, again, I watched the Blu-ray. This isn't a brag, but it does have, as well as the commentary, it has some deleted scenes. And sure. There's a scene that I'm glad was deleted, in which Picard is even worse.
Oh,
it's it was deleted from the scene, you know, where they're walking up and down the observation lounge and he's explaining what the mission ultimately is to, you know, give them a tantalizing sort of target so the Maquis can commit as many resources as possible and then we'll arrest a lot of them and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And Ro basically says, like, under that thing, she's like, well, what if they don't take the bait? They will, it'll be too tantalizing and they'll commit as many as possible. And she's like, but the Maquis, you know, so your plan is basically to have enough ships that they will ultimately turn themselves in. And he's like, yeah. She's like, well, I know them well enough to know now that they're not going down without a fight. They won't just, you know, park their ships up and hand themselves over to you. And Picard's like, well, I hope they do, because if not, we might have to disable their ships. And we all know that sometimes is impossible without some kind of, you know, major casualties. And I was like, what the fuck? So Starfleet are basically just like, well, if they don't, we'll kill them.
Right. I was like, yeah.
Not good.
It's not. Yeah.
I was like, geez, Luigi. I mean, I know Starfleet are torn and, you know, I can understand. Again, I'll get into that when we talk about the kind of the Maquis of it all. But I was like, I do not recognize Picard and certainly that version of Starfleet that would be like, well, if they don't want tough shit, we'll kill them.
Right. Yeah. No, that's, yeah. It's weird.
I mean, it's not made explicit, but even the way that's kind of implied is just like, no. So I'm glad it wasn't just me anyway with that team where I was like,
yeah,
out of character with the whole court-martial threat. And
yeah, really, really was. He's usually very, like, genuine.
Yeah, and even at the very end, like, I really do like the scene where she basically does eventually, you know, decide. She blows the mission, and Picard's immediately like, oh, when she comes aboard, take her into custody. Like, what the... Again, you know, very quick to come to that, Picard, but okay, I understand. And what kind of struck me as weird is that, like, Riker is so much more respectful to her than Picard is.
Yes! And Riker was a dick to her when she first came on.
But not just when she first came on. I mean, when they lose their memories in that one episode and they kind of, they know that they have something going on and it's kind of a hate, not a love thing. Or he's never really has felt like he was, you know, her number one fan, shall we say. But at the very end, I really was touched and it felt like they gave Riker what should have been Picard's response, which was to be like, you know, oh, take care of yourself, Ro. You too will, you know. And even when he says to Picard, look, I felt like she was very sure she was doing the right thing. So,
yeah,
I'm like, wow, this is so, like, why is Riker of all people like, you know, you've got to understand.
And he was so nice to her on the shuttle when, like, he was like super chill about like being held at gunpoint, basically. And
that's what I mean. Yeah, the way that she's like, look, Will, I'm sorry, you can keep the ship, you can go back to the Enterprise, but I have to do this. And he's like, look, take care of yourself, bro.
Yeah.
Very, you know, like, it's not like, how dare you?
Just wild. Anyway. Yeah.
But anyway, I'm going to ask a question. And again, sorry to put you on the spot. I'm not even sure if there is necessarily an answer, but how well do you think the episode develops Ro's backstory and her motivations for ultimately joining the Maquis and leaving Starfleet?
I feel like when it starts, maybe this is that whole cliche thing that, like, now that we're older, we're, like, more used to being able to identify that stuff. Like, it's obvious from the beginning that Ro's going to be stepping over to the Bajoran side or the Maquis side for this. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if it's just the way they wrote Star Trek episodes back then.
Mm.
And it's easy to, like, see the formula. That's the word I'm looking for. The formula for what they're doing.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I didn't think it was a great setup for her to get her from point A to point B, I guess.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I think I didn't mind the setup as such because it kind of logically it makes complete sense. Mm-hmm. And I think if I'd been in the writer's room and they were like, oh, here's an idea. We've set up this idea of the Maquis. What if Ro, who's never really felt like, you know, she wanted to be under Starfleet rules and regulations, and she's a Bajoran, she has her own issues with Cardassians. What if she joins the Maquis? I would be like, oh, okay, that's cool. But the episode's justification, like you said, is so wrapped up in cliche, and that's really the only word I can use, just, you know, convenience, I guess, or whatever.
It almost feels like they just needed to write an episode in, like you were talking about, the behind-the-scenes stuff. Like, they just had to do something to make it worth the money.
Yeah, but it is. It's the kind of thing where, again, it's too much for a single 45-minute episode, and I think it would be so much better if they'd sort of had an arc where they were seeding bits and pieces of this over maybe a few episodes, or, you know, a couple of handful of episodes over the season, where we dotted back and saw that she was railing against Starfleet a bit more, or another episode somewhere where the Maquis were involved and she was starting to be sympathetic. But it's too much for one episode. And like I said, I was just groaning at her relationship for the most part with Macias, the older guy.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, ugh. Although credit where it's due, I did think it was well written and believable in one scene when she's talking about her father and you know, how he
instrument. That was beautiful.
Yeah, that was the one scene where I was like, if you'd written the whole thing like this.
Yeah, I wrote that down in my notes of like that being a moment for me.
Yeah, definitely. Because I mean, even before that though, when he's talking about, oh, if you can make me great Tasparat and whatever, and I'm like, this is just so obvious what's happening here. And then, like I said, the absolute, you know, bullseye on the nose of, oh, when an old soldier dies, someone takes my place. Wing, yeah. Wing. Oh. You know? That was just like, who really thought this was, you know, subtle in any way, shape, or
right.
Just no. So no, I mean, I think, like I said, the Maquis connection made sense, but it was just too rushed and, like I said, too cliche written for the most part. Would you agree with me on that one?
I would definitely agree. Yes.
Yeah. We've kind of answered the next question I had, but just to kind of clarify it, I think. So how do you feel about Picard's, you know, treatment of role here? Is it justified? Is it out of character?
And does
it
change the role?
Yeah.
He's usually so fatherly in a good way, you know, like.
Yeah.
And this just was so brash, especially for somebody that he knows like what her past trauma is and her history. And to put her in a situation like that to begin with just seems ill-advised. You know, like, I'm not a fan of the way his character was written for this one at all.
Yeah, I mean, towards the end, certainly, like I said, I didn't really mind. I kind of get, like, you know, when they're all despite the impropriety, I kind of got the kind of, oh, I'm so proud of you, and oh, thank you for your faith in me, Captain. And
yes,
you know, that kind of all made sense. But it was then, like I said, she'd already lied to him about the mission, implying that she wants out. She doesn't want to do it. And his response is, well, I could have had you arrested for lying, so I suggest you go ahead and or get court-martialed.
Right? But,
come on, man. See, she's struggling here, for crying out loud.
Yeah, no, for
and,
real.
You know, I mean, we've established the Maquis. It's not like a, you know, it's not a black and white thing. They are shades of gray. It's not like, oh, I'm leaving you to join a known enemy that hate you and want to destroy you. It's kind of, they have their justifications.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, that was kind of going to bring me to my next question when it comes to the Maquis, is that, again, I always feel like these episodes barely scratch the surface because they're just too complicated.
Yeah.
And Picard, again, I said most of the episode, other than that one scene, I was fine with, but I lied, basically, because there's another one where...
I can't court-martial you for this.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I genuinely, I'd forgotten I'd written this, but yes, I remembered, like, when he's talking to girl Yvette, and they kind of have that, like, back and forth, and Yvette, you know, they say the same line back, which is, oh, it seems like you're having limited success because we've been attacked. Well, we were attacked, you know, a week or two ago, so you're having limited success as well, and, you know, the little... You know, the usual dick measuring contest that you get in these scenes. But but then Picard's like explanations about the Maquis is just, again, it seems, and it's only this one plot line where he seems like this, but he seems very, you know, he's decided they're bad. And it's the way he says, like, what was it? When he's talking to Nachiev after he's spoken to Yvette and says, look, I understand, you know, we caught the Cardassians supplying some of their colonists, and I'd keep a phaser under my pillow with the Cardassians, but it's gone beyond self-defense now. Mm-hmm. We both want peace in the demilitarized zone, which is a questionable statement to start with. And then even sympathy has to end at some point. I'm like, does it?
Does it?
Like, how do you decide
this? Anti
Star Trek in general, really.
Yes, it's anti-Star Trek, but it's also very anti-Picard. I mean, if you, I don't know why this came to my mind, but I was like, for some reason, I immediately thought of Insurrection, the movie, and I'm like, sympathy has to end at some point, but you are willing to throw away your career, you know, stand up with these Baku colonists, of which there were only like 90 of them, as they point out, and be like, no, it's wrong. Doesn't matter how many people, doesn't matter what you're doing, doesn't matter about the benefits you're getting out of it. It's wrong, and I will firmly make a stand. And I'm like, where was that Picard when it's like, well, I'm sympathetic, but sympathy has to end, you know? It's just, it's totally not, and it's only the Maquis that brings the worst out in Starfleet, because they don't, the writers don't seem to really know, like, they realize it's kind of justified, and they can't have the Starfleet officers going, but well, probably best to turn a blind eye, you know, they're justified or whatever, so they have to come across as really harsh and authoritarian, and it's just like, I don't get it. Although I did think the way it was explained when he says, you know, a peace treaty isn't just a piece of paper. Okay, that I can get on board with. That makes sense to me. I understand where you're coming from with that. You know, it has to mean something. If it doesn't, we're going to blow up into war. But, you know, like I said, it's just, it's all in the phrasing and the way you're writing it. You write one good line and then you write sympathy has to end. And I'm like, it doesn't. That's just nonsense. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Anyway, so how do you feel about the episode, the way that it deals with kind of navigating loyalty and duty to, you know, I guess Starfleet in this case, or whatever you want to substitute for that, versus your personal conscience? And did you feel it was powerful enough in the way it kind of dealt with Ro sort of struggling with that? And you know, the others that we mentioned as well, maybe Picard, the way he's very pro-Starfleet again in this?
Right. I think it would be stronger. If Picard was actually sympathetic to Ro's struggle.
I see what you're saying, and I mean, I think, again, it's such an interesting idea that I would have loved to see Ro wrestle a little bit more with it, because
I just don't think we had 45 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it tries, like I said, by showing her at the start being like, but then again, I kind of hate that it narrows her entire Starfleet experience down to, oh, it's just about Picard.
Yeah.
Because I would rather, you know, she made friends on that ship, and she, you know, she's in 8 episodes, and she developed a bit of a, you know, a character there. Yeah. And so breaking it down to, oh, I don't give a crap about Starfleet, I'm just sad I let you down.
Right.
It's kind of like, well, hang on. But yeah. And I also have my issues with, like I said, a lot of the way that Picard treats her. And I am, without wanting to get too far into next week's episode, I'm so glad that they eventually had the two of them deal with this and had him called out on his BS. But again, more on that next week, because I recently watched that back, and I'm just like, oh, I am so freaking pleased that some writer had her put, you know, in his mouth, like, no, your respect and love for me was entirely conditional. The second I did something you didn't like, it was like, oh, you're dead to me. Like, hang on.
Real.
So, yeah. Anyway, we'll get to that next week, but I'm just glad this wasn't the last word in it, because Picard doesn't come off well, as you said.
Really doesn't.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't really have anything else to add about the writing. I think I've kind of talked about the things that we didn't like and where we think they kind of falter a bit.
Yeah, it definitely could have been so much better written.
Yeah.
Maybe the Maquis need their own series.
Well, that's kind of what I hoped, and what a lot of people think hoped Voyager would be. I mean, not that I didn't love Voyager for what it was, but the idea of, you know, a ship in conflict between these two forces just never went anywhere.
Yeah.
They immediately assimilated and were fine and worked together perfectly. Within
it was very rarely an issue.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right, fair enough. But, you know, you could have had something really good, especially with how kind of entirely, you know, moral to a point, you know, black and white Janeway was about, like, no, we must immediately follow all Starfleet protocols and we must track down our technology if it gets stolen. And it would have been really interesting to have some of them like, going, nah.
Right.
We don't really want to risk ourselves for this.
It would have been realistic to their character to do that.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, that's a different matter. But yeah.
Yeah.
Although, to be fair to the episode, I do also like the idea of the mission that Ro goes on for the Maquis to kind of prove herself. I like that Kalita, first of all, isn't just immediately on board with her.
Yeah.
Because it made it, again, for 45 minutes, it was nice to have at least one character be like, I'm not so sure about you, love.
Right.
When everybody else is immediately tripping over themselves. Oh, welcome aboard. Oh, welcome. And so I like that. But I also like the idea that you have to go through a mission to kind of prove yourself to her.
Sure,
and yeah, it was kind of cool. It made sense as far as my limited geek knowledge of, you know, get through the shields, beams, and medical supplies. She probably would have been caught, but Picard and Worf were like, oh, well, it's Ro. Let's just let her through. We understand what's happening here. Right. So, yeah, I got that. That was cool. Yeah. but, yeah. And I have to say, I mean, it's as much as a lot of the lead-up was cliched, it's not like Ro was a character. It wasn't believable that she'd do that, that she would turn, because we've established enough about her to,
yeah,
in the other episodes, to be like, okay, I get it. Fair enough.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Before I move to the acting, then, a very big potential question for you. Oh, you're going to hate me for this. So, yeah, why is it that you think Ro's story resonated enough to, you know, ultimately bring her back 3 decades later? And what impact did this episode have on the narrative about Ro, the Maquis, the Federation, etc.?
Hmm. You're right, I hate you.
Bye, everyone!
That's it. I'm done. Bye. This is all Jordan's fault.
Jordan would have had an answer.
Right, exactly. They bullshit so much. No, I'm just kidding. Okay. Why? Say the question again.
Well, so that's, it's kind of one long thing, but I'll break it down. So first of all, why do you think Ro Laren's story resonated enough to ultimately bring her back in Picard? And I mean, I think I'm probably not alone in saying this episode resonated and that being the conclusion to her story, because we kind of come to know and come to like that character, even though, like I said, I was surprised to learn she's only in 8 episodes, because it feels like more.
It does,
and she was always, I mean, I know not everybody does, like Vian hates Ro, but I love the character. And whenever she appeared, I was always like, oh, yeah, cool. And, you know, we'd come to, like I said, her last appearance was the episode Rascals that we've talked about just before this, where...
Yeah.
We'd learned a lot about her, and she'd had her childhood again. And she, like I said, she'd bonded with the crew. We saw her bond with Geordi when they thought they died because they were phased in that transporter thing. And you know, I'm not going to go through all 8 episodes she's in, but ultimately, like I said, I think for me, I've answered the question myself there. So for me, it had a kind of an impact. But what was it that you felt had an impact about this? And, you know, is it the character, the actress? What?
All right. Again, I love Ro Laren. I've loved her from her first appearance on Star Trek. So anytime she comes back is a joy for me. And with all the weirdness of this particular episode, they did really lean into the fact that she is grateful to Picard and respects Picard no matter what is happening. And that Picard looks at her, and I'm going to say, looks at her as someone that he would mentor and cared about on a human level more than just a career level.
Yeah.
So I think that's why it shows that it hits him so hard at the end of this episode. Because it's like having a piece of your family backstab you.
Yes. But that's also what I was going to say.
Yeah. Without the writing of Picard for this particular episode, like generally speaking, you know that he's in conflict, that he knows that Ro's following her heart and that she's not exactly in the wrong on this.
I don't know if he does. Well, not in this episode. I'd never got the sense that he was understanding of it at all. Not
this episode. Just like Picard in general, that's how you would expect him.
I think that's kind of why, again, without getting too far into it, I think that's ultimately what the point of the return in Star Trek Picard is.
Yeah.
Is to get him to that point to admit, oh, because he still starts out being like, no, you did wrong. You completely wronged me. And it's only by the end of that that he's like, oh, I actually now see you were very right in what you're saying. And I understand and I see every aspect of what you are. And But yeah, I mean, it's weird because it hadn't really occurred to me before. But and maybe I'm, you know, putting my own spin on this, I guess. But to me, it kind of seemed, as much as they're slight tipping over into the kind of romance part, I don't think they're going for that with him.
No.
And I think it kind of feeds into Picard's kind of, you know, he starts out by saying he doesn't like children and he doesn't want to be a family man and whatever, and then gradually warms more and more as the show goes on.
Yeah.
And I think she's kind of like, if I have to characterize our relationship, I think she's kind of like a surrogate daughter to him.
Yeah.
And then that's kind of the way he, as I said, it's kind of like he's been betrayed by family at that point at the end of it, because it's kind of a closer relationship than just a, you know, work colleagues or manager and, you know, employee.
Yeah.
But again, that feeds back to what Ro eventually ends up saying, which is that, you know, if you do care about somebody that much, you see them and every aspect of them, not just what they can do for you and not just, you know, how many, you know, kids have been like, oh, I don't want to go into the family business or whatever. Right. That's kind of what this is in you know, science fictionized terms, you know.
You got to love them for everything they are.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that's kind of why it resonated with me as well, as just the fact that, like I said, Ro is such an interesting character. Mm-hmm. And again, they mentioned in the commentary that this episode wouldn't work with literally anybody else on the Next Gen or the Enterprise crew. You wouldn't believe it with anybody except Ro.
Yeah.
So if they were going to do this story and, you know, feed it into the Maquis and so make them more relevant again, it would have to be with her. So I think it did. It's one of the rare times, because I'm not really a huge fan of the Maquis, but it's one of the rare times I got it and I understood where they were coming from. And I kind of liked that ending for Ro, even though I was kind of feeling for Picard at the time. So, and again, like I said, it was always nice seeing Ro as a kind of three-dimensional character. And as much as I love, you know, the Roddenberry ideal and stuff, it is nice sometimes to have a character who's not perfect.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
Yeah.
It gives it more texture.
It does. Yeah, it does. So anyway, yeah, sorry. I'll stop asking questions then. So we're about to get potentially controversial or unpopular. Because the next section to talk about is the acting. First of all, let me see. I liked Richard Poe as Gullivec. He appears in Next Gen, DS9, and Voyager, so it's a nice bit of continuity. But I think he's also a really good actor. Like, he doesn't have much to do in that scene, but he has a certain gravitas and a kind of tone to his voice when he's talking to Picard that I was like, oh, I like this. And I already mentioned I love Natalia Nagulich as Nechayev. I think she's kind of a cool character, and it's nice to see that recurrence of an admiral without just like one episode and she's evil kind of thing.
Right.
I loved Shannon Cochran playing Kalita, as I've mentioned. It was nice to have somebody that wasn't just immediately, yeah, come on board, here's all our secrets. So she felt, you know.
Some reality to the situation.
Exactly. I was going to say three-dimensional, but no, real, exactly. You know, they're a terrorist cell at the end of the day. They're outlaws. They wouldn't just be like, oh, come on in. Yeah, welcome. Right.
They're going to be suspicious of everybody.
Some in the commentary, they're really like they are not afraid of pointing out the flaws. I'll get to one of them because they savage Patrick Stewart's direction. But one of the things they mention, and they're debating whether it's the writer's or the director's fault, is just the fact that Ro goes into the bar and then like Data and Worf immediately follow her in.
Okay,
like,
right.
Wow, Don't give her time to settle in or anything. Like, that's not going to look suspicious.
That, and then there was the other moment when the three Cardassians come into the cell community thing in those red robes. And it's they're not standing out like a sore thumb at all, are they? Like, three guys in red robes with the hoods up. That looks suspicious.
I still didn't put together that they were Cardassians until they actually took the role, because I'm just dumb. I was like, hang on, who's this? What's going on? Is this a Starfleet kind of, you know, framing you for something? What is this? Oh, it's Cardassians. But again, in the commentary, they mentioned that the writers are so annoyed at that scene because they said, like, it was constantly a fight with special effects pre-CGI to sort of, like, they said, we'd write, like, oh, you're going to have a cool, epic pitched phaser battle. And you'd get a note back that's like, how many phaser shots do you want? And they'd write like, I don't know, 12. And they'd write back, you can have 6. Like, well, how in the feck are we going to make it look like a convincing, you know? It's like, and they're like, so we have to basically come up with clever ways where it's just like, okay, well, we can maybe have 3 where you can hear them, but you don't see them. Because you have to see the one that hits the guy that kills him. And I'm like, oh, man, TV production in the 90s, I don't know how you put up with it. I'd be like, no, I'm so annoyed. I asked you for a 12-shot fight, damn it. That's what I want.
That budget's brutal.
I know it is, but they were saying like that's how it was, because it was like you've got to, before CGI, like I said, you've got to paint in the effect, but you've also got to paint in things like the way that the laser beam would reflect on the faces of the person shooting and the person hitting, and the way it would react and the way it would react with the environment. And it's like they said it would cost something like $8,000 or whatever per phaser blast. And I'm like, oof, God, keep it off screen, Jesus. I don't blame you.
Wow.
Yeah, and I think they said at one point, they were like, I think I understand now why the original series eventually came up with like sonic disruptors or something at one point. Like, you don't need to see anything, you just hear like, oh, look, it blew up.
Oh, that's great.
It's got nothing to do with the acting, but it is kind of like, it's kind of, so it's hard to do, you know, you've got your limitations, I think is my point. But anyway, sure. But yeah, acting wise, like I said, it's not like Patrick Stewart doesn't give a good performance, but he's so out of character for most of it anyway.
Yeah.
That kind of, I think that affects his performance, although credit where it's due, that last scene, even though he is just sitting there, is damn powerful. You know,
yeah,
it would have to have been to have sat with me for that long. But yeah, kind of we've already touched on it, but I'm kind of glad it's not just me. It really did feel like Michelle Forbes just wasn't as good as she normally is in this episode.
Yeah, and when you said the whole thing about like they were kind of off, like the relationship wasn't the same on set for her.
Yeah,
like that made a lot more sense. Like that she felt.
Yeah. I don't think it was so much on set. I think it all, I don't know if we talked about this the last time, but the idea that basically she was offered the role that would become Kira in DS9, like it was written entirely for her. It was supposed to be Ro. She would have been, because you can actually go and check it out. It's on the various websites that the show Bible initially had written it as, this is Lieutenant Ro Laren. She's going to be promoted in a Next Gen episode. We'll cross her over. She'll be like the Bajoran first officer. She's going to be best friends with Dax, have a, you know, antagonistic relationship with Quark, etc. So they'd written it, you know, the entire show with basically her in mind as the first officer of it, and then offered it to Michelle Forbes, and she was like, no, I don't want to do TV. I want to do movies. So naturally they were like, well, F you. We wrote you an entire thing. And that's when they had to kind of pivot and create the Kira character, which kind of worked out because the Nar Visitor is great and Kira's a good character. But
yeah,
you can see, especially in those, I think you said that last time or somebody did, you can see in those opening DS9 episodes, it is just Ro. There's no tremendous difference between the two characters. That's just what she's playing, what you're given. But yeah, so I think the point is not so much the cast or whatever, but the behind the scenes people, the writers, the producers were very upset with Michelle for snubbing them in their view of like, well, you know, why would you do that for? So yeah, it was, there was probably a certain coldness. And like I said, she did just seem like she was, I don't know, I think I've written in my notes, like during the first scene when she goes to the Maquis and she's getting interrogated, she just seems either bored or like she's kind of sleepwalking or just paint by numbers acting, I guess. It just feels, there's no emotion there. And normally I'm not super critical of acting, but even I noticed and was kind of like, this is, oof. And she's so good as an actress. I mean, if you look at the way she acted in Ensign Ro, which is the only one we've kind of got, you know, on record as seeing, but she was so much better there, you know, so there was so much power and impact in the little things and her kind of, you know, her crisis of conscience and does she go along with the Admiral or turn against him? And yeah, I know she's a better actress than this. So
right. Yeah. No, I felt it too, for sure.
Yeah. I'm pleased it wasn't just me because like, and I mean, it's not every scene, like I said, when she actually does the scene, whether or not it's because she was directed to it or it was an earlier take, so she was fresher. But when she does the whole, like I said, oh, my father used to play in that instrument that you're talking about, and I used to always be able to sleep, etc., etc., she's really emotional there, and I'm like, okay, this is more like it, but for a majority of it just doesn't seem quite right. And like I said, some of it might be direction. And whenever somebody kind of feels like that as well, feels exhausted, I'm always told, well, you know, you do multiple takes in a show and this might be like take number 30 and the actor's just like, I just want to go home. I don't even care. These lines have no meaning to me anymore. I mean, you're going to know this more than most. Look who I'm telling. But yeah, so there's a chance, like I said, it was just a take that they used where she was just like, ugh, I don't care. Yeah. But I get the feeling like, again, this is, we don't know for sure, but I do get the feeling she was kind of like I said, this is the penultimate episode of the show. She probably thought, haha, I've gotten my 2 episodes worth of money and I'm not going to be called in. And then gets told, hang on, the second last episode we want you for. And she's like, oh, I don't want to do it.
Damn.
So, yeah, I mean, like I said, not her best performance, not terrible. There's that one good scene. I think we both agreed, but
Yeah,
as I said, standout performance wise, Jonathan Frakes weirdly impressed me in a very small role because, like I said, it was nice to see him warmed to Ro in a way that we hadn't seen. And I'm not just talking about that end scene, I mean, like when she does that mission and Picard's like, oh, let her through, she's obviously got somebody with her. And Riker's like, aha, guess I know what they mean now by advanced tactical training.
Yeah,
like, oh,
yeah.
Riker's got a bit of respect, you know,
exactly. Yeah, he was good.
Yeah. So is there anything else about the acting that you wanted to mention or you wanted to bring up? I haven't.
No, I think we're on the same page about that. I agree that Ro's performance was a little lackluster compared to what we know she can do.
Yeah.
And, you know, Picard, like, Patrick Stewart always gives a good performance. But yes. Yeah, it just feels weird on this character because it's so atypical.
Yeah, but it's kind of like, I don't know if I would blame the actor or the writer in that, as you say.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't blame the actor for that.
And I mean, the director is him as well, so you can't really blame him. So yeah.
I'm just saying. Wouldn't blame the actor. The writing probably didn't help.
No, like, I think that's what it really is. Like, he, so much. The whole point is that he sold it believably, but it is so out of character that it's like, well, I still don't believe it. So anyway. Now, speaking of the direction, as I said, the direction is by Patrick Stewart, and it is, it's not his first episode of TNG. He's done at least one, maybe a couple more. I think a lot of the actors ended up doing directing. I can't say I noticed anything particularly bad, and I liked a lot of what I had seen. But then, like I said, when I listened to the commentary, they were super critical. Yeah. And I get the sense that they were kind of, for whatever reason, the writers just seemed really bitter about the idea of, like, cast members directing. And
I get that.
Really?
I don't know. It's kind of like there's something kind of self-serving, I would say, about, and it doesn't feel so weird in a series where you have a different director for every show, practically, kind of a thing, you know, like they cycle through. It doesn't feel as weird as like doing like a film or doing a show, like a theater show, like though doing a film or a theater show where you're the director and also like a main character in the show, that feels so self-serving in a way. On a television series like this, it feels less so because I look at it, because it ran for so long, as an opportunity for actors to like try out other areas of the film industry in a safe place where, you know, they've got mentors around them, or, you know, they've been here, they know the routine. And so like, if you've been an actor on this show for 5 years and you're like, I'd like to try my hand at directing to see if that's something I'd like to do. Like, I could see that being a thing. But in general, I'm not like a huge direct it and be in it, at least not for a huge role.
Yeah, I get it. And I kind of, and part of it is also they kind of mentioned during the commentary that they were kind of advised without being told that, you know, if an actor is directing an episode, maybe write less of a part for them to do. So, that's, you know, fair. If Patrick Stewart's directing, don't make it a Picard heavy episode.
Right.
But obviously, you know, if it is part of the plot, you can't write Picard out of this one because he is, you know, an important part of it. But again, it's not like it's not the Inner Light where he's like in every scene and it's all about him and whatever. But I do remember the first episode he directed, Patrick Stewart, was In Theory, where Data basically gets a girlfriend. And I do recall, even at the time I first watched that as a, you know, as a young 14-year-old or whatever, thinking it's so obvious that he doesn't want to be in this because he's got one scene. And it's just when Data approaches him and he goes like, I would need advice about my relationship. And Data, and Picard just goes, Data, I'll be happy to give you any advice on women. When I have some, I'll let you know, and just walks off. And that's his entire role in that episode. And I'm like, okay, all right.
Nice.
It's funny, but it also means that, like, acting wise he's got one sentence and the rest of the time can be dedicated to directing. But yeah,
exactly.
Oh bless. So anyway, yeah, but no, I mean, like I said, I'm not obviously au fait with directing and things, so I don't really, beyond the kind of surface level, I mean, I do have a film studies degree. I know enough to know if something's terrible, but I don't really know the composition of shots and everything the way some people do. And like I said, this one writer on the commentary was really critical and said, like, look, every frame is what he calls center punched, where everything's like super close up and the actors just, it's just their face and nothing else. And a lot of the time it leads to them spiking the camera, which I kind of, noticed, but didn't mind. I thought that was the point because it is kind of a dramatic character piece, so I kind of thought that was a deliberate thing. And they do say, like, oh, it's because it's being directed like a stage play, which I guess would probably be what Patrick Stewart would, that would be his sensibilities. And I'm like, I can understand where you're coming from. That makes a kind of sense. But then a couple of small things they mentioned. The one scene when they go to the Enterprise bridge at the end, apparently Worf is out of focus and it really bugged them. I didn't notice. Okay. he's in the background anyway, so it wasn't a huge deal for me. And they criticized the idea that just to have them doing something in the observation lounge scene, they had to be kind of pacing up and down, which
I hated
felt really
that
weird.
So
and
much.
I didn't notice that until they said it, and once they said it, I was like, actually, now that's all I can see, and it really like, is annoying.
Very uncomfortable because I'm like, y'all are just walking back and forth in this like it was really awkward for me to watch that scene.
Yeah. But what else could you do? I mean, if that's the set you've got, it's either that or sit still. And it's just it's such a dull scene.
it is just a dull scene. But okay, so that scene was shot completely as a master shot, meaning that everybody's in the film. There's no like point of view takes or anything like that. Like they could have done some different like over the shoulders if they were talking like face to face. Just this back and forth thing was just like so dull and
Well, I have to say I thought the direction was fine for me, but I understand if other people are critical of it, and again I've been informed by the commentary where the flaws are. So I can't disagree with that, but for me it was fine.
If
it was a movie, I may have been more critical, but again, for episodic television,
yeah
I kind of just follow the story, you know. So anyway, in terms of kind of VFX production design, there's a couple of things I wanted to mention, but again, sorry if it's boring or dry. First of all, I mentioned this in the last episode, but I noticed correctly that Ro is now missing the little ridge wings at the top of the Bajoran nose makeup that she had in her first appearance. They're not there. And we mentioned that last time, like that makeup changes, and for some reason, even in Ro, they give her the Bajoran without it.
But, is that what's different about her face?
Yeah, and it is it is noticeable because it gives a kind of extra harshness, especially, I mean, Michelle Forbes has got quite an angular face anyway. No offense, she's a pretty woman, but she kind of has, you know, a very angular appearance. And then when you add the kind of wings above the eyes, the way that it kind of does something, and then it just seems to fade more and more, because then when she appears in Picard, she barely even has the wrinkles on the nose. Huh. Times I was just like, hang on, have they even bothered to give her these? And they're there, but they're so faded.
Fascinating.
So the only other thing I was going to say is that I was super impressed by the matte paintings in the episode of the Maquis establishment, the planet and everything that they use for setup. And I was like, this is incredible. How is this so good? It didn't occur to me that it was because they are all completely redone when they did the Blu-rays. So it's like the original matte painting's been replaced by like CGI enhancement. And that's why. You know? So they have the people on that were doing it, the Okudas who do the enhanced effects and stuff. And they were like, oh no, I mean, it was good. The painter that did it was fantastic, but you'd never get this depth of field and this level of intensity and whatever without us going in and adding a little bits of CGI flourish here and there. And I'm like, okay, that's why it looks good.
Right.
Really, it does.
That's
all I have. I did make a note that it was nice to see the Federation Peregrine fighters. That's the little
the
little wing chip thing at the very start, because you rarely ever see them. And I'm not sure I agree with the idea that Starfleet has fighters in the first place, but you know, I guess you have to always defend yourself. Moving to the music and the sound, I have literally one note because I'm terrible with this. And again, when it comes to television stuff, it just seems like unless it's really intrusive, I don't tend to spot it. And the only thing I noticed was, like I said, because it was such a soppy scene anyway, the scene where Macias is like, I know in your heart you're one of us and all the rest of it. It just got so soppy. And so I was just like, ugh. This scene is already like, you know, cliche 101 by adding cliche like soap opera music to it. You're making it so much worse. I'd have been tempted to just have that play out in silence, like, look, we know this scene is already over the top, let's just leave it at this kind of thing. It was just like, ugh, what are we doing? So did you have, I mean, are you better with music and sound than me? Did you pick up on anything? Or?
I didn't pick up anything on this. Music and sound tends to be a sore point for me, just as a judge for film festival things. I like, even going through film school, it's like audio is like so overlooked in general on film sets, I guess, but It's like that one thing that if it sucks when you're watching it, it ruins the whole film.
That's the thing. It's kind of like with direction and with music and sound, I tend to only notice if it's bad because it brings you out, or if there is some like one particular choice that's like really, you know, interesting and stands out, but in a good way. Like I just saw the movie Weapons, and without spoilers, there's one scene in that where it is completely not silent, but there's no, you know, diegetic music. There's no sound outside of, you hear a ticking clock and just regular sort of ambient sounds, and it stands out as, it's so much more powerful and creepy than whatever else, because it's just like you're so on edge, you know. It really brings you into that scene, and I was like, oh, that was a really good choice by the director to have this scene play out without, you know, sinister music in the background telling you how to feel or whatever. So I didn't really get any of that from this episode. It just felt, you know, it's fine.
Nothing stuck out to me sound wise for any of this, so
that's fair enough.
Everything was leveled correctly, so I could hear it all.
And I mean, sound effects wise, it clearly was worked. You know, it wasn't like a phaser blast happened and I heard a scream or something. You know? Somebody added a cat meowing where it should have been a phaser blast, whatever. But
that would be great. They should do that.
It would be funny though. Somebody should.
Go through the whole series and just change out random sound effects or something.
When an old soldier like me gets clawed. Anyway, so well, that's not really much else to do. I'm gonna move to the next bit, which is gonna not take very long because it's the section that I call subspace communications.
Incoming transmission.
And that's where I basically open up the floor to anyone that wants to comment on social media about their opinions on the episode. And I tend to try and ask, and I'm doing my best to kind of keep it interesting and ask the, you know, questions about the episode, but for whatever reason, I'm just not getting feedback from the audience as much anymore. And I think I have like three or four, maybe, including one decently long one. So I will read them out. But like, audience, if you're listening to this, please respond to my prompts. I don't know why you're not. And I'm just, it's a nightmare to try and get them to respond. And what's more frustrating is the amount of people that see the prompt that asks like specific questions and then just leave a like. I'm like, oh, that's so frustrating. Like, I'd rather you just didn't bother as opposed to like, I like this question, but I'm not going to answer it.
Oh, I hear your frustration. That is valid.
Exactly, yeah. So anyway, moving on to what I do have. On Blue Sky, Terry Long says, Next Gen and DS9 did more thematically interesting things with the Maquis than Voyager did. Okay, fair enough. On Discord, in the Star Trek server, FrankFury74 said, Rose turn made sense for the character. I thought it was a good juxtaposition. Obviously, I side with Starfleet, although I understand the side of the Maquis. I give the episode 3.2 out of 5. So, that's fair enough. And finally, this is the quite long one on Threads. Arcade Addict Brain says, I was disappointed in Ro. I understood why she did it, but I honestly think it was also a way out for her. I disliked the references that were made during season 3 of Picard, as if it were his fault that she decided to leave Starfleet the way she did. Again, more on that later. She made a choice, and so she chose. She turned her back on the one man that gave her a chance when no one else would have. Until they decided to get extremely bold, I could understand the Maquis as well. When they started going full terrorist is when I was like, okay, enough of those guys. Not that Starfleet is perfect. There are plenty of examples of when they failed miserably too. As to the episode, it was decent enough, though I was also disappointed that we wouldn't have Michelle Forbes around anymore.
Yeah.
Okay. Don't really agree with any of that. I have to say, I disagree with the, other than the not, you know, being upset not to have Michelle Forbes around. But I mean, the show wouldn't have been around. So
yeah,
I understand the point. It would have been nice if she'd taken that DS9 role, I think. And if anybody is interested, by the way, she does have a role in the DS9 relaunch novels, where she basically does take on the Kira role. She joins the Bajoran militia and becomes assigned as first officer now that Sisko's gone, and gets assigned to the station. And you can read that. It's not canon, obviously, especially now that we saw Ro's actual fate in Picard. But it's an interesting way of, you know, seeing that character through the road that might have been. So all that remains then is for us to give our favorite things and then our conclusions and scores. So we'll start with our favorite character moment and line, as we always do. And this is where I'll hear an epic groan from you. You're like, oh, I forgot we have to do this nonsense.
I wrote down notes.
That's dedication for you. I love it.
I know. Oh, I sat down this morning and wrote down notes, and it would help if I remembered what questions you ask, so
Oh, well, just favorite character, favorite moment or scene, and favorite line, if you can remember one that sticks.
I think I can get that from what I have here.
Okay.
Cool. All right. So we're doing favorite what first?
So favorite character would be the first one.
Oh, favorite character. Let's see.
It's a tricky one. I'll be honest. There was even I was like, I mean, I guess, you know.
right. Yeah. How about that poor guy that Ro assaulted in the bar the first time?
I mean, we don't know anything about it other than he didn't really seem to mind the non-consensual assault.
And then he had like a funny bit when she came back.
Not tonight.
Call out to the featured background.
I've just remembered as well when she finally does stop snogging him after like a solid freaking 2 minutes or whatever. Snogging, right. He's trying to pull her back and she's like, it was nice to meet you.
And you know what? Props to him for taking that rejection so well.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially in the 90s.
but keeping the hope as well, so that when she walks back in the bar, next time he stands up like, ooh, maybe. Oh.
I hope that actor runs across this podcast one day.
It was a good little, I'm happy for you to give the supporting artists their due. If you want to say that was your favorite character, go for it.
We're going to go with that one today. Yeah.
Awesome.
We all know I love Ro, but, you know, it was a weird.
Well, that's what I mean. She wasn't great in this episode. I just said it's not even Ro's best episode, but I guess I'd go with Ro because of the stuff that does work. But I was struggling, to be honest, to think of her favorite character. Picard is so out of character. Yeah. I would have said Riker, but it's too small of a role almost to feel like it was justified. And I would have said Macias, but I would have said Macias, as I said, but he was just so like, I'm 2 days from retirement. Yeah. Oh, anyway, next favorite moment or scene in the episode.
Favorite moment would be when Ro is talking about her father and the Clavion instrument and that whole story that she gave, and that moment was so powerful, especially compared to everything else in the show.
Yeah, we are so in agreement, weirdly enough, when it comes to this episode. It rarely happens. Whenever I have Vianne on, she usually argues with me about stuff. Anyway, so my favorite scene, I did like that, as you'll see, but my favorite scene was just the ending, the way that it's such a gut punch, because like I said, it stayed with me for 30 years. And it was the one thing from this episode that I really vividly remembered after seeing it for the first time, so I kind of have to give it to that.
Absolutely.
Do you have a favorite line that springs to mind, or
hold on, I wrote down a couple, so let me look at this. Oh, Rikers, now we know what they mean by advanced tactical skills.
Nice. Well, you'll probably appreciate mine, because I actually went with the speech that goes, my father played the Clavion when I was very young and afraid of monsters under my bed. He'd play for me. He said that the Clavion had special powers. Monsters were afraid of it, and when they heard it, they would disappear. When I listened to that music he played for me, I was never afraid to go to sleep. When he died, I realized even he couldn't make all the monsters go away.
That last part of that quote I wrote down too.
I know, right? It's like, wow. Like, why did you turn up to write that one sentence and then forget, you know?
I know, like, what happened?
For the rest of the writing, just like, this will do. When an old soldier dies, that'll do. Whatever. I really am bitter about that line. Can you?
Really are, yeah.
Come on, man. Anyway, so then there's only two of us to do this, so I guess we'll give our conclusion and our score out of 5 stars. I better let you go first, because again, I've written a small essay, as I always.
I'm sure you have.
would you like to go first?
To no one's surprise, this is a little bit of a rough episode for the writing and the acting. So not a super big favorite. I will give it a gracious 3.5.
Wow, that's quite gracious.
Right? I'm a nice person.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a great score, but as you said, I think it's understandable for sure. Okay, so my film review magazine style essay is a deeply flawed episode with moments of real resonance. I hadn't revisited it in years, and my memory had preserved only the good parts, the emotional beats that are here, but they sit alongside some lazy, cliche writing, a few sleepy performances, and a rush to explore big themes that the plot can't quite support. The idea of tying Ro's past to the newly introduced Maquis is solid, but Michelle Forbes' portrayal doesn't always capture the weight of that connection. There are bright spots. Her scene with Picard is excellent, and moments with Macias land well, but too often it feels like we're skimming the surface. The ending is the strongest part, giving the episode lasting impact, though it comes at the cost of Picard acting uncharacteristically unfair and harsh towards Ro. As a younger viewer, my hero worship blinded me to how unreasonable he is here. Revisiting it now, it's hard to miss. Patrick Stewart's direction is more than competent, I thought. Jonathan Frakes gives a commendable small performance. And there's enough here to avoid calling it a waste of time. In the end, preemptive strike should have been Ro Laren's perfect send-off. Instead, it's a farewell with a brilliant last page and a messy, uneven story leading up to it. Powerful moments survive, but they're buried in writing and choices that never rise to the occasion. Thank goodness this ultimately wasn't Ro's final goodbye, but more on that later. I actually give it 3 out of 5. A decent episode with clear strengths, but held back by too many flaws and missed opportunities.
Okay.
So... yeah,
I do appreciate your synopsis is like that.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Well done. A lot of thought goes into those, let me tell you.
Truly.
More those do take a while to run. Yeah, well, probably, yeah. There's more than once that I've written something like that out and thought it would make sense and then have had to text a friend and be like, does this make sense to you? You know. I'm not going to tell you what it's a review of, but does it make sense is all I'm asking.
Context would be helpful, but...
Exactly, yeah. But anyway, so yeah, putting those scores together, dividing by 2, I mean, we know. We can work out what the average of 3 and 3.5 is. The final score was 3.25 out of 5 for this episode. Yeah. So I think that might be the lowest currently of the Bajoran Cardassian season, actually.
Oh, man. Rough.
I think, yeah, I think the lowest at the minute is 3.3, so that's just now potentially gone into lowest spot. Okay. So. Rough episode, though, as you said, very rough episode. We'll see if the final part of the trilogy can stick the landing next week.
Yeah, but, I'm looking forward to it.
Indeed. In the meantime, this wraps up our discussion of Preemptive Strike, a farewell that hits hard, raises difficult questions, and reminds us that not every resolution in Starfleet comes with a neat log entry. So, yeah, massive thanks to my returning Ro Squadron member, Rune. Always appreciate your tactical analysis. So, yeah, been great having you on board again. Is there any project, social handles, or subspace channels that you want to boost while we're here?
No current projects, but you can catch me on socials at Rune. What is my social handle? At Rune Actor. That's my social handle.
Yeah. I'll always put it in the episode description, but it also is on the Ensign Ro episode description anyway. So
yeah, so, yeah.
You were here for that. So yeah, at Rune Actor everywhere, I think is what you said. So
yeah, that's what I put. So, sounds good.
Awesome. And I wish Jordan well. I did get a message from her, by the way, to say that for some reason, Mastodon just didn't send the messages through until just like about 20 minutes ago. She's apologized and said she's really sorry. She had sent me a message at about 5:10 to say, are we recording? I haven't got a link, but I didn't get that until 20 minutes ago. So clearly it's Mastodon's fault.
Wow.
So
see, I told
massive
you it was
apologies. Yeah, it's tech issues, always technology. It hates us. He says using technology to record. Uh-oh. But,
gotta be nice.
Yeah. shout out to Jordan. I'm really sorry you couldn't make this episode. Hopefully you enjoy listening back if you do. And we'll definitely make sure you're going to be on next week's episode, Jordan.
Same, Jordan. We missed you. Big hearts.
Definitely, definitely. And as for us, you can find the show by following our handy link tree in the episode description or staying to catch our outro at the very end of this episode. If you're enjoying the show, do the Federation-approved thing. Rate, review, tell your crewmates. It really does help us out more than you know, and help us to grow. Why not? We'll be back soon with more of this particular Bajoran moral quagmire with added shapeshifters and a long overdue reunion as the Ro trilogy reaches its final mission with a review of the much teased Star Trek Picard season 3 episode Imposters.
Yes.
Looking forward to that one. So and until then, keep your comm badge tapped, your instincts sharp, and remember, we are Starfleet. Live long and prosper.
Live long and prosper.
You have been listening to the Hit or Miss Star Trek podcast, part of the Hit or Miss Who Trek channel. Hit or Miss Star Trek is hosted by Mike Wilson, scripted, produced, and edited by Mike Wilson, based on an idea by Mike Wilson and Will Templar. Follow us on YouTube, your podcatcher of choice, and our social media. Links to all of these can be found by clicking on the link tree in the episode descriptions. This podcast is a Media Matters original production. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share this podcast throughout subspace. We'll be back for another thrilling trek through the stars soon, but for now, hailing frequencies closed.
Try to warp out of here at once, maximum speed.